We come now in our study of church history to a discussion of the persecution of Christians in the early church. And the study of persecution is always a timely subject in light of the fact that, as I hope you are aware, we live in a world where persecution continues. There is a tremendous amount of persecution against Christians in almost every Islamic country. Islam, by its very nature, must persecute Christianity if it is going to be consistent with the Quran. And in the Sudan, we have the worst persecution taking place right now. I can guarantee you, if it was any other religious group, if it was a ethnic minority group, what's going on in Sudan makes anything that was taking place in Kosovo look pale. But you don't hear anything about it. And it's very simple why, because it's against Christians. And the media doesn't care. The simple fact of the matter is we saw in our media taking an incident with Matthew Shepard and turning Matthew Shepard into a national icon of hate crimes, and yet, as I mentioned a few weeks ago on the radio program, there is a murder trial, I believe, in Arkansas. Was it Arkansas? In Arkansas, of two homosexuals who sodomized and raped a young boy and killed him, that you've probably never even heard of, unless you go digging through the internet to try to find it. This kind of an attitude is all across our world today. There is persecution in Muslim countries, in the Sudan, and of course we all know about China as well, where there are people running around saying, oh, all is well in China, you can do anything you want, yeah, as long as you don't actually proclaim the gospel. So persecution is nothing new. It can take different forms. There can be persecution against Christianity by other religious systems, or by governmental authorities that are based upon religious systems, and that's primarily what you have going on in the Roman persecutions during the first 250-300 years of the history of the church. But you also have persecution that is based completely upon religious concepts within what the world would view as Christianity. And so much of the persecution that takes place from, say, let's say around the turn of the millennium, around 1000, through the 1700s-1800s, is quote-unquote Christian versus Christian. In reality, we would not use that type of terminology. We would say state apostate church versus Christian. But the world does not wish to make distinctions based upon that kind of a that kind of recognition of biblical truth. And so Paul, for example, experienced both kinds of persecution. Paul experiences persecution against Christianity in general from governing authorities, and he also experiences persecution based merely upon religious concepts, the persecution of the Jews, and he also experiences persecution that comes in the form of the activities of false teachers who attack him personally, who seek to have him and his authority removed from the churches, so on and so forth. Now, it is generally the thought amongst many people, and if this is still available, and I don't know that it is, this is getting fairly old now. Let's see, when was this put out? It's a Christian History Magazine. It's probably about 1991 or 92 or so, so it's getting a little bit older, but sometimes they have back copies. There was an issue number 27 of Christian History, is Persecution in the Early Church. It's a very interesting read in regards to the subject of persecution, and there's all sorts of interesting stuff to read in here. I'm going to read you a one little section from it and pass around and take a look at it. But there's a lot of works that have been written out there, and yet it's not really a subject that we like to focus upon. It's one thing for us to read about martyrs and about persecutions, but if we're really brutally honest with ourselves, we have to admit that it's not really a subject that we want to dwell on a whole lot, simply because of the fact that we know in our heart of hearts is not something we want to experience. There were those in the early church that actually sought persecution and sought martyrdom. Most of us would not quite understand their kind of perspective and viewpoint. We live in a situation where we have the freedom to speak God's truth, and yet there are times, we all have to admit, when we have felt the pressure of the society around us to keep our mouths closed. We haven't wanted to experience the rejection of men, and we all have to admit to our shame that there have been times that we have not spoken when we should have, because we feared, in that case, only verbal persecution, maybe just simply being disliked by some people, not even the physical persecution. It's interesting, I've noticed something, that when, for example, most of you know that a group of us go out to Mesa during the Easter pageants, and we pass out tracts. We go to Salt Lake City and pass out tracts. And people often say, well, aren't you afraid someone's going to, haul off and whack you or something like that, and shoot you, stab you, do something to you, while you're doing stuff like that. And, that's really not the thought. We've had one fellow who got slapped, and I think that's just because he didn't eat enough, there just wasn't enough to him to cause anyone to stop from slapping him, actually. So a couple people in the room are chuckling right now because they know exactly what I'm referring to. But we had somebody about the second year we did it got whacked with a lawn chair, as I recall, by a little old man that's whacking him with a lawn chair. That's been about the should I tell him about that one incident, Rich, where Rich is going, oh no. Years ago when we were much younger than we are now, Rich did have a Mormon get in his face, and he learned that probably the best response was not the one that he gave, which was go for it, buddy, or something like that. Yeah. Okay. So you live and learn over the years as you do things. Go for it, buddy. Does not work too well in situations like that. George can get away with it, but
go for it, buddy.
No, thank you very much. That's really not the first thought across my mind. It's interesting. You actually, if you talk to folks about this the first time, they're a little more concerned about what the first words of insult that are going to be spoken to them are. They're not so much worried about someone hauling off and whacking them. They're more concerned about the first time someone looks at them and says, you creep, go get a job, get a wife, crawl back underneath the rock you crawled out from underneath. Believe me, I can give you a very long list of ones I've heard. That seems to be more of the concern. And so when we talk about persecution, and I would not consider that persecution at all. That's in comparison to what Christians go through throughout the world, that's not even an issue. When we think about it, we automatically, the question that maybe we don't consciously think about it at first, but it has to be there in the back of our mind, is how would I respond? What if I were there? When we read about martyrs in the New Testament period, we read about martyrs in the apostolic period in the early church, the question immediately crosses my mind, what would I do? Would I be willing to do what they did? And of course, we believe that God gives grace in those situations. He doesn't give it before the event or too late after the event. God gives grace at the time of the event. And so it's difficult for us to put ourselves in that situation, but we can't help but thinking, what would happen if I were faced with the possibility of losing, well, my life? Okay, most of us can see ourselves, standing for the truth, in that type of situation. But isn't it interesting, that's normally not the way that Satan does things. Normally the attack is not so much upon your immediate life as it is upon your friends, your possessions, all the things that in this life you might be holding dear that maybe you shouldn't hold dear in the first place in comparison to Christ. And so, for example, Islam learned early on, after it began sweeping across North Africa, that the best way to deal with the Christians was not to put them to the sword, because as Tertullian and others in the early church said, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. The more you kill us, the more we grow, because people see the dedication it is ours. Instead, they recognized the best way to get rid of the Christians was to tax them to death. Limit their opportunities for economic advancement, limit their opportunities for education, keep them in the gutter, in essence, and that worked really well. That worked really well because it's one thing to muster the courage for the one great stand. It's another thing day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, decade after decade, to be treated despitefully and unfairly for one's faith in Christ. And that seemed to weed out the true and the false a whole lot faster than anything else did. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Most of the time when we think about persecution near the church, the idea is, well, it starts around the 60s, and you see, you hear about Paul probably being beheaded. There's also whichever one, you know, it has the same effect, one way or the other. You hear about Peter being crucified upside down. You hear about this persecution beginning in the middle of the 60s. And the idea is it goes on for, 250 years until 313. That's really not the way that it happened. When you really look at it, from about AD 30, where you have the establishment of the church, Pentecost, you have the persecution beginning by the Jewish leaders, the stoning of Stephen would be a good place to place the real beginning of persecution. The arrest of the apostles, maybe in Acts 4, would be another good place. Up to about AD 250, so for about 220 years, the persecution is local and it's occasional. So there are periods of time, especially in the middle of the second century, where most Christians had relative peace, where it was not you did not have the Roman emperor saying, okay, everyone everywhere, the entire governmental authority of Rome, wipe out the Christians. That did not take place until after 250 to 311 is the time period where the entire might of Rome for a concentrated period of time attempted to stamp out the Christian faith. Now, that does not mean that the local persecutions of the place were not incredibly severe, for they were. But they were generally based upon a local leader basically getting really upset with the Christians. Maybe the local leader was very zealous for the local gods, the local pagan deities. Maybe the local leader was motivated by the fact that you see, for example, in the book of Acts, when Paul begins to preach the gospel in certain places, the sales of the pagan creators of images begin to fall off. They're not selling as many of their pagan deities to people, and so they get mad, and of course, money and politics have always gone hand in hand, and so all of a sudden there's persecution against the Christians because of the result in the culture of what is going on. But there would be different reasons, and it would, for a while, there would be a tremendous, for example, toward the end of the second century, around late 170s, early 180s, there was a tremendous persecution in Gaul. Well, there wasn't a tremendous persecution at the same period of time in Palestine or in Asia, but there was in this one particular area, and many Christians would die in that particular area and during that period of time. And so it ebbed and it flowed. There were decades of peace interrupted by either sporadic local persecutions or then you have wider spread persecutions. It went back and forth during that period of time. Now, when you think of persecution near the church, what's one of the first incidences that crosses your mind and that is extremely famous? When you think of a political leader, who's the first one that comes to mind? Anyone remember?
Nero.
Nero's persecution. Nero is emperor of Rome from 54 to 68. And Nero was a total fruitcake. Okay, we are talking. He would even look strange in California. Okay, and that's saying a lot, really. Most of you have. What's the famous line about Nero? What did Nero do? Nero fiddled while Rome burned. There you go. There's the the concept. Let me read you a section here about Nero's cruelty. This is an account from the Roman historian Tacitus. This is from a Roman historian. This isn't some Christian writing about these things. This is written around 115. This is only about 50 years after these events took place. But all the endeavors of men, all the emperor's largesse and the propitiations of the gods, did not suffice to allay the scandal or banish the belief that the fire, the great fire of Rome, in the summer of 64, had been ordered. Now, this is back up just a little bit. There was a tremendous fire in Rome. It just happened to be centered in the area that Nero had wanted to clean out anyways. It was sort of in the low-rent district, shall we say. He wanted to see some renovations made, had been thwarted in so doing, and then all of a sudden the whole area goes up in flames. Isn't it interesting how that particularly took place? Obviously, Nero was behind the fire. He wanted to clear land for more buildings in his own honor. And these folks in their homes were in the way, and so Nero basically torched them. Well, the people really did know what happened, but Nero, as so many politicians are wont to do, decided to find a scapegoat. I continue with Tacitus. And so, to get rid of this rumor, Nero set up as the culprit and punished with the utmost refinement of cruelty a class hated for their abominations, who are commonly called Christians. Crispus, from whom their name is derived, was executed at the hands of the procurator Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. Checked for the moment, this pernicious superstition again broke out, not only in Judea, the source of the evil, but even in Rome, that receptacle for everything that is sordid and degrading from every quarter of the globe, which there finds the following. Accordingly, arrest was first made of those who confessed to being Christians. Then, on their evidence, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much on the charge of arson, as because of hatred of the human race. There was the accusation. Remember, Tacitus is writing this, about 8 years after the death of Ignatius. So we're talking early on, if you've got your little timeline going there, 115 isn't way down the road. And so, what is this idea, this hatred of mankind and gross superstitions? Well, it is nothing new for Christians to be grossly misrepresented by those who hate them. But the Christians did certain things that caused these kinds of accusations. They would not engage in the type of pagan revelries that the society around them would engage in. I remember when we read from various of the apostolic fathers, one of the constant themes was this emphasis upon holiness, unwillingness to kill children, the type of morality that was theirs. And, people who are inveterately immoral don't like people who are moral. By their activities, they cause conviction. And so there is no end to the hatred that will be shown to those who act this way. So it is amazing that people who actually show love for God and love for one another and love for the children that would be abandoned at the doors, which was their form of abortion back then. It's a girl. I don't want a girl. But stick it outside. The dogs take care of it tonight. That level of absolute hatred of mankind was rampant in the Roman Empire. And yet those who would practice that would turn around and say that those who would not do that to their children, and who would in fact go and find those children and rescue them and put them up themselves and raise them themselves, that those are actually the people who are haters of mankind. If you can't see the parallel of what goes on today, then it's too early in the morning and we need to start bringing donuts and coffee to give everybody a glucose shot so you can hear exactly what I'm saying, because the same thing happens in our society today. It's incredible. Anyway, not so much on the charge of arson as because of hatred of the human race. Besides being put to death, they were made to serve as objects of amusement. They were clad in the hides of beasts and torn to death by dogs. So they'd wrap them up in the hides of various sundry animals, and they'd attach the hides so the person couldn't get it off, and then they'd set packs of dogs on them and laugh and enjoy themselves as the person was torn to death by these dogs. Others were crucified. Others set on fire to serve to illuminate the night when daylight failed. Nero had thrown open his grounds for the display and was putting on a show in the circus, where he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer or drove about in his chariot. All this gave rise to a feeling of pity even toward men whose guilt merited the most exemplary punishment, for it was thought that they were being destroyed not for the public good, but to gratify the cruelty of an individual. And there is a drawing here of Nero in his gardens, and you can see people, if you look closely at it, being lit up. Christians would literally serve as his torches at night. And he would invite the Senate and he would invite his friends to come to his garden, and he would take Christians and wrap them in stuff so that after they were dead and their bodies started falling apart, they wouldn't fall all over their death. And they would burn people, and you would actually have Nero and his friends strolling through their gardens to the shrieks of dying people who are burning on these poles. That's how absolutely degraded the Roman Empire had already become. In fact, I think most people would admit, who have studied anything about history, that the amazing thing is not that Rome fell, it's that it lasted as long as it did. That the decay is already clearly and evidently seen in this early period of time. So, Nero, there are many people. I think, Mr. C, have you read Dr. Gentry's stuff on Nero? Because I had someone just say I needed to get some book that he had just written. I know that Ken Gentry is leading proponent of post-millennial viewpoint, right? A little bit louder, I can't hear you. Kenneth Gentry? No, because I know that he spoke up at Emmanuel, unless I'm confusing names, I don't think I am. He spoke up at Emmanuel last year, and someone just gave me his email address. He likes to mock those that are into trying to figure out what the mark of the beast is, and so much so that his email address is ksomethingg666@cs.net. And he says it keeps all the wackos away from writing him any notes. But I'll have to check my email, because I think we're talking about the same guy. Either way, he's written a book demonstrating that 666 was meant in the Hebrew language. When you add up the letters of the word Nero, they add up to 666. And that in light of the incredible persecution that Nero engaged in there in Rome, that it's his view, of course, that that is the identification of who the beast is. And certainly the early Christians did not exactly hold Nero in a great deal of esteem, shall we say, and did see in him the very picture of the satanic rule of the Roman Empire that was persecuting them. So Nero dies in 68. Yes, sir. No. I'm just saying my understanding was he had recently written a book specifically on, specifically attacking all the various theories that are running around, where people are trying to, well, the mark of the beast is going to be computer chips in people's foreheads and all the stuff that people have added up to 666 and all the rest of the stuff. And the thesis was, hey, if you look back at the book of Revelation and you look at the context in which it's written, Nero was seen by the Christians as the beast, and that it makes no sense to try to find some other fulfillment. This was what was being communicated to me. So I didn't know if you would look at the book. The view that Nero was the beast is pretty much as old as the church. I mean, that's been around from the beginning. It's just, I was just mentioning that the books are still coming out and presenting that, and that that was a book that had just been mentioned to me yesterday in an email, actually the day before yesterday home too. So you have Nero, he dies in 68, and then you have a diminishment of persecution for a while. The Roman authorities are pretty much left on their own as to how they deal with these people. Up until the middle 60s, the Jews had already worked out an arrangement with Rome, in essence, that gave them a great measure of freedom. And you can see in what happens with Paul, I believe it was in Philippi, that Christianity was seen by, at that early stage, the Roman leaders and the Roman officials as basically a variant of Judaism. It's just a sect within Judaism. Yeah, you've all got the same scriptures. You all fight amongst yourselves about this. And so for a while, Christianity was able to take advantage of the establishment of Judaism, in essence, to have a certain level of freedom. But especially after the Roman persecution, that's no longer the case, and Christianity is seen as a movement unto its own, and people are really not sure how to deal with this Christian movement. Local leaders take different viewpoints. Then you'll have emperors who come to the throne who are more or less interested in this particular subject and more or less likely to bring persecution. Domitian, 81 to 96 is his date, fairly lengthy period of time. He went to new heights in promoting the imperial cult. The imperial cult. The emperors began to see that their, Rome spread across a vast body of land with a vastly diverse population. Holding diverse populations together has always been the downfall of empires and nations. Look at what we just went through in the Balkans. And if anyone thinks that that problem has been solved, you need to realize this argument's been going on there for 1,000 years. And, all the technology in the world isn't going to stop a feud and hatred that goes back for 1,000 years. Well, Rome had the same problem. They had swept across the face of Europe and North Africa. And it's one thing when you've got big, strong armies, you've got the lead in technology, you've got the lead in tactics. The legions, the Roman legions were incredible fighting machines, and they had ways of winning that a lot of folks hadn't thought of before, and so there weren't very many large nations that could stand before them. It's one thing to sweep across a bunch of land and conquer it. It's a whole lot harder trick to hold on to it, to manage the everyday affairs of commerce, maintain communication, and somehow put up with the fact that all these lands you've gone across have different languages, and different religions, and different customs, and different ways of doing things, and you've only got so many Roman soldiers to stand there with a spear and say, do it our way or else. So holding it all together is not easy to do. And the emperors could see that there was a problem here, and so they attempted to find ways to make people happy, shall we say. And on the religious front, Rome was known for being very pliable, in the sense that you've got your local deities, you've got your gods that you worship, cool, no problem. But just add in something. Add in any recognition of our authority, or in the case of the rise of the imperial cult, what eventually developed, not quite as early as Domitian, but this was a large step toward it, what eventually developed was this concept of the worship of the Caesar as a demigod. And it was, the idea was, you can worship your gods all you want, but you also have to give fealty, loyalty, and worship to the Roman state god. And so Domitian really pressed the concept of the imperial cult with himself as the head. He saw this as a means of unifying the various sections of the empire. He demanded that he be confessed as Lord and God. Now, in Greek, that would be Kurios and Theos. And you know what Christians believe about who Kurios is. The very confession that marks the Christian faith is Jesus Kurios, Jesus is Lord. But he wanted people to say Kaiser Kurios, Caesar is Lord. Well, obviously, there were two especially, groups within the Roman Empire that simply could not say that. The Jews and the Christians, neither could make that kind of statement. All were made to swear by the genius of the emperor. He had statues of himself placed in many temples throughout the empire. Persecution broke out in many places, for both Jews and Christians could not offer the demanded sacrifice. And most feel, now those of you who heard the program over the past few weeks, the past few days on Wednesday and Thursday on KPXQ, where there was a fellow on, and Mr. C, did you catch any of those programs? They had a hyper-preterist on. You would have found it most interesting, or you would have sicked your dog on the radio 1-2. I'm not sure which exactly would have happened, but they had a hyper-preterist on, and it was a fascinating discussion, but of course, he... Yes, sir? Well, I was about to say, his perspective was that every biblical prophecy was fulfilled in AD 70. I mean, it didn't matter what was brought up. Everything happened in AD 70. Christ returned, the resurrection took place, and he even had a rapture taking place in AD 70. I mean, nothing is left for the future whatsoever. Someone even pointed to 2 Peter chapter 3, where the elements melt with the fervent heat and so on and so forth. He said, well, that was AD 70, and the element is the temple. And, I mean, everything was wrapped up in AD 70, and he said, Josephus said that Christ returned, and all the rest is wonderful fun stuff. And was seen by the Romans, the whole nine yards. It was very, very interesting. But anyways, he said that all New Testament books, every single one, was written pre-70. It's interesting that most Christians believe that John's exile to the Isle of Patmos took place during Domitian's reign. He said that it would have had to have taken place during Nero's reign. The problem is Nero's persecution was only in Rome. Domitian's was empire-wide. That's one of the problems that I had with the theories that he was throwing out there, is that John is in Ephesus. He's not in Rome. Nero's persecution did not touch Ephesus. Domitian did, and would have logically resulted in John's banishment to the Isle of Patmos, where he is separated from his loved ones. And I don't know if any of you have ever seen, a number of years ago, there was a play that was performed over at Ethington Theater at Grand Canyon. And it's called John... St. John in Exile. St. John in Exile? And there was some famous actor that did it, too. It was Dean Jones. Okay, because I... Okay, all right, because I saw it at Canyon in Ethington Theater with this, you know, most famous actor I'd ever seen, anyway. You can tell I don't get to Hollywood very often. but it was very interesting to... and there's also been a film, as I recall. Or were there video... Were there clips? And I can't remember. It's very vague in my recollection, but... That's what I thought it was, yeah, that's what I thought it was. I've seen somewhere, some film or something that depicted what life was like there and some of the elements of the persecution, but it was not in any way, shape, or form a pleasant thing to experience. Now, next week I'll try to remember to bring, unless someone has a copy of Bettinson's Documents of the Early Church with them, I'll try to read to you, yeah, I'm sure you all just carry that around with your Bible. I didn't bring it with me this morning, but I want to read to you letters to and from Trajan, who was emperor from 98 to 117. There's some letters that go back and forth that I'll read next week that illustrate the interesting, almost middle road that is taken. The idea, we actually have a phrase that would describe Trajan's viewpoint. Don't ask, don't tell. That was the perspective. Basically, the letters say, you know, we don't really need to be wasting our time chasing these people around. But if someone becomes open, openly confesses this pernicious faith, then they need to be killed. It was a capital punishment type situation. So it was the don't ask, don't tell period of persecution there under Trajan. Marcus Aurelius is emperor from 161 to 180. Now notice there's a leap from 117 to 161. And again, there are sporadic persecutions within areas, as I said, toward the, especially around 170 during Marcus Aurelius' time, but during that period of time, there's generally more peace in the sense of a lack of persecution. Sure, there's still persecution in the sense that if it's a capital offense to be a Christian, and the local governor in your area decides he doesn't like you, then he can make take advantage of that. But generally, there were other things keeping people's attention at this time other than just chasing Christians around. So Marcus Aurelius, 161 to 180, was known as the Stoic Emperor. While persecution had been sporadic up at this time, under Marcus Aurelius it became more acute. Anti-Christian literature, such as that of Celsus, if you want to know the first person to really write a blistering attack upon the Christian faith, Celsus is the writer of a book called The True Doctrine. The True Doctrine. And it is a blistering, scathing attack upon Christians. And don't fall out of your chairs in utter shock, but it grossly misrepresented almost everything Christians believe. The media doing that? How can it be? Well, again, if we look at church history, we discover that we're not experiencing anything overly unusual or anything new as far as that goes. It became very popular, which in turn elicited further apologetic literature from the church. Origen wrote Contra Celsus, against Celsus, and other writers likewise wrote books debunking the errors of Celsus, which does prove that Christians have, down through the histories, written books in response to other people. Some of you know that I'm writing a book in response to someone right now, so you might know why it's important to me. So Marcus Aurelius proposed laws against what? Evangelization. He said, hey, let's make this simple. It's one thing to be a Christian, but let's pass laws against evangelization. And as Baruch Ma'az shared with us, was it a full year ago or just a little bit less than? It was like March or February or something. I can't remember when it was. I know he's coming. Thank you. Yes, he is coming back. I didn't know that. And it was in this room, too. I sat right there. Anyways, he has mentioned to us that, of course, this is an issue in Israel as well and is becoming an issue again. It had sort of faded for a few months, but now it's back in the news. That the Orthodox Jews in Israel are pushing for a law to ban evangelization by Christians of Jewish people there in Israel. And so this has been going on for a long, long time. I mean, we see it in the book of Acts. Stop speaking in this name. And what is the only response that Christians can offer to that? Well, I must obey God rather than men. There is a direct command, really, situation. So he proposes laws against evangelization, and very quickly, last point, and we'll pick this up at this point, in 177, a great persecution broke out in Lyon in Gaul, which I mentioned to you already. It was at this time that Justin Martyr, who we'll look at here in a little while, Justin Martyr is one of the most famous writers of the second century. That's where he earned his name. Justin Martyr was during that period of time in 177. Tertullian remarked during this period of time sarcastically, if the Tiber rises too high or the Nile too low, the cry is, the Christians to the lion. All of them to a single lion? I guess Tertullian at least had some sense of humor in the midst of all the difficulties that was his. So. Anyways, we'll it's going to be a few weeks until we pick up with Trajan and the persecution, because I'm going to be in San Antonio preaching at a Reformed Baptist church next week. The week after that, I'm preaching at a Reformed Baptist church in Syosset, New York. And the week after that, I think I'm in Pennsylvania somewhere. So it's going to be a really busy time here at the end of this month. So it's during the time of Marcus Aurelius. I'm not sure the exact date of Celsus. probably around 160, approximately. All right, let's close the word prayer. Father, we're thankful that you have been faithful to your people even through the most difficult times in the past, and we ask that you would help us to remember our brothers and sisters who are under persecution even this day. And Father, that you would help us to love your truth in such a way that if we were to face the persecution, we would know what is most important. We ask that you would be with us now as we go into worship, open our hearts and our minds, and we may understand your truth. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.